When you look at a massive sprawling city, you really see two completely different approaches to survival and growth.
Right, yeah.
Like on one hand, you have the towering skyscrapers. These are, centralized, highly optimized monuments to efficiency. Everything from the climate control to like the elevator routing is just perfectly orchestrated.
Oh, it's a marvel of engineering, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the downside, though, is the rigidity of it all. I mean, if the central power grid goes out in that skyscraper, or say a single critical water main burst, the entire multi-million-dollar building just shuts down instantly.
Right, everything just stops.
Exactly, everything stops.
And then on the other hand, you have the sprawling neighborhoods at the street level,
Yeah.
which are, they're a bit messy, highly decentralized, and definitely less hyper-efficient,
Yeah.
but they are incredibly resilient. Like one block loses power, and the rest of the neighborhood just keeps humming along.
Yeah, that classic tension between optimization and resilience is, well, it's everywhere in technology. We are absolutely obsessed with centralizing for efficiency right up until the exact moment things break.
And that tension is exactly where we are taking you today. You are listening to The Deep Dive, and today we are looking at this massive industry-wide tug-of-war happening across the tech and entertainment landscapes.
It's a huge shift.
It really is. We are going to connect the dots between an earthquake in Google's AI leadership, chips that literally carve intelligence into stone, a catastrophic educational cyber attack, and how the gaming industry is fundamentally changing how it survives.
Yeah, we have a lot of ground to cover.
We do. So, okay, let's unpack this, starting with what feels like a seismic shift over at Google.
Yeah, a seismic shift is, honestly, putting it mildly, we are looking at the most significant internal realignment since the AI boom really started. So Demis Hassabis, who is, a Nobel laureate and the visionary founder of Google DeepMind, he's actually stepping down as CEO of DeepMind. Yeah, he is transitioning to become the chairman and Alphabet's chief scientist.
Which, I mean, on paper, that sounds like a massive promotion, right?
It does, yeah. But you have to look at what is happening concurrently. At the exact same time, Jeff Dean is leaving the company entirely.
Oh, wow.
Right? Jeff Dean has been at Google for, what, 27 years? He is the underlying architect behind the core infrastructure that makes Google, well, Google, things like MapReduce, Bigtable, TensorFlow.
Right.
And he's leaving to start an independent public benefit corporation called Discovery Loop.
Okay, so you have the brain behind their AI and the architect behind their entire data infrastructure, both stepping out of their day-to-day operational roles at the same time.
Exactly.
So why now? What's the catalyst?
Well, Hassabis actually released a staff memo explaining his transition, and one specific phrase in there just set off alarm bells across the entire industry. He stated that he needs to step back and focus on the big picture because he believes AGI, artificial general intelligence, an AI that can basically outthink humans across the board, is, quote, close at hand.
Wait, he just casually dropped that into a Tuesday morning staff memo?
He really did. But the market, they reacted with anxiety rather than excitement. Alphabet stock actually declined following the news.
Seriously.
Yeah, because this raises an important question regarding the structural changes happening inside the company right now. DeepMind's communications, legal, and marketing teams are currently being merged with Google's core corporate teams.
Okay.
And historically, DeepMind's absolute superpower was its autonomy. I mean, it was this insulated lab focused purely on fundamental research, which is how they achieved massive world-changing breakthroughs like AlphaFold.
Right.
But now they are being integrated into a highly bureaucratic, product-driven structure.
It kind of makes me think about the difference between building a rocket in your garage versus like managing a commercial airline.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Like when you are building that rocket in a garage, it's all about rapid iteration. You break things, you take massive conceptual risks, and nobody from legal is coming down and telling you what color to paint the engine, you know?
Exactly.
And that was DeepMind in its early days, or even Jeff Dean innovating those core systems. But managing a commercial airline, that is Google today.
Yeah, it's a completely different beast.
Right. It's about safety, predictable quarterly margins, integrating into a massive bureaucracy. So you can completely understand why visionaries like Dean and Hassabis are seeking environments with fewer corporate constraints. I mean, Dean's new venture, Discovery Loop, being structured as a public benefit corporation, is highly intentional.
Oh, very intentional.
It legally protects that fundamental research freedom from shareholder demands.
Yeah, and the timing of this internal friction is incredibly dangerous for Google. I mean, the competitive landscape has literally never been fiercer. OpenAI still dominates consumer mindshare.
For sure.
Anthropic is aggressively winning over enterprise clients. And Meta is essentially giving away incredibly powerful open source models, which is undercutting everyone's pricing.
Right.
So in that environment, losing your visionary architects creates a massive vulnerability.
And here is the kicker. If Hassabis is actually right, if AGI really is, you know, close at hand, the industry is facing a massive physical roadblock.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the general purpose hardware and software currently running AI is going to buckle under the weight of that computation.
Yeah, it's just not sustainable.
You can't run the future on generic infrastructure.
Ugh.
Which brings us to the radical specialization happening in AI hardware right now. So let's talk about AMD acquiring a Toronto-based startup called Talos.
Yeah, Talos is super interesting because they are taking a completely different philosophical approach to how we process AI. To understand what they are doing, you kind of have to look at the bottlenecks in current hardware.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So today, AI runs on general purpose chips. When you ask an AI a question, that chip has to constantly run back and forth to its memory banks to fetch the weights, the mathematical data that actually makes up the AI model.
So it's like a chef who has to keep running to the pantry for every single ingredient while trying to cook a meal.
Yeah.
The actual cooking part is fast, but the running back and forth takes up all the energy.
That is the perfect way to look at it. That memory access takes time, and more importantly, it consumes a colossal amount of electricity.
Right.
So what Talos is doing is they are eliminating the pantry entirely.
Wait, how?
They are physically etching the AI model's weights directly into the silicon pathways of the chip itself.
Whoa.
Yeah. The data just flows continuously through fixed circuits that are optimized exclusively for that exact model, no fetching from memory at all.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting and honestly a little counterintuitive to me.
Okay.
If a model is hardwired into the physical silicon of a chip, you literally cannot change it.
Right.
Like, if you want to update your AI, you basically have to throw the physical chip in the garbage and manufacture a new one. I mean, a standard GPU is like a digital billboard, right? It takes power to run, but you can change the ad whenever you want. Talos is carving the ad into a literal stone tablet.
Yeah. They are.
So why in the world would a company spend millions on hardware that can never be updated?
It all comes down to the brutal economics of AI at an enterprise scale.
Mm-hmm.
Think about production deployments that simply do not need to change every week.
Okay.
Like, if you run a massive global e-commerce site, your core AI recommendation engine might remain perfectly stable for a year once it's performing well.
Oh, I see.
In that scenario, paying for the flexibility of a general-purpose digital billboard is just a massive waste of electricity and server space. Talos claims their hardwired approach results in inference speeds 10 times faster with dramatically lower power consumption.
So AMD is buying them to essentially outflank NVIDIA where it hurts.
Because
NVIDIA completely dominates the market for training AI with their general-purpose chips. But AMD is looking ahead and saying, hey, the real money isn't in training new models. It's in running established models cheaply for the next decade.
Yeah, it's a brilliant long-term play. And that drive toward deep specialization, it isn't just happening in the physical silicon. Software infrastructure is undergoing the exact same transformation.
Right.
Which is perfectly illustrated by the recent release of Redis 8.0.
Yeah, and Redis is absolutely everywhere. If you use the internet, you have interacted with the Redis database today, guaranteed. And in version 8.0, they are introducing native vector sets in beta. So how does this tie into the AI specialization trend?
Well, what's fascinating here is how foundational tools are adapting so developers don't have to string together 10 different specialized programs.
Right.
In modern AI, information isn't stored as simple text. An AI doesn't read a sentence. It converts that sentence into a high-dimensional vector, like a 1536-dimensional vector.
Right, embeddings.
Exactly. Imagine trying to organize a giant library. A traditional database organizes by the author's last name. But a vector database organizes the books by vibe or theme.
Okay.
This allows the AI to find concepts that are mathematically similar, even if they don't use the exact same keywords.
Which is why we've seen this explosion of highly specialized, dedicated vector databases over the last few years, right? Like Pinecone, companies having to buy completely new tools just to handle the vibe sorting.
Exactly. But Redis 8.0 is bringing that capability directly into the database developers already know and use. They are introducing native commands like VADD and vsim that handle vector math at blinding speeds using standard algorithms like FLAT or HNSW.
Wow.
They claim query processing power is up 16 times compared to older workarounds, and it's up to 87% faster overall. So just like the Talos chip, software is becoming hyper-optimized to do one complex thing incredibly efficiently within a centralized system.
But there is a massive danger lurking inside all this hyper-efficiency.
There really is.
When you optimize everything, when you consolidate your tools and centralize your operations into these massive specialized skyscrapers, you create a single point of failure.
Yeah.
And when that single point fails, the collateral damage is frankly unthinkable. Which brings us to the Canvas LMS breach.
Yeah, the Shiny Hunters breach of the Canvas Learning Management System is a terrifying case study in exactly that kind of collateral damage.
Look, if you, your kids, or basically anyone you know has taken a college or high school class in the last few years, you almost certainly used Canvas. It is the centralized backbone of modern education. It's used by over 40% of U.S. colleges.
It's massive.
It holds everything. Your grades, your submitted essays, private direct messages with professors, financial aid flags, and cyber criminals just walked away with 3.65 terabytes of it.
Yeah. Between April and May of 2026, the attackers exposed 275 million users across nearly 9,000 educational institutions worldwide.
That is just, 275 million.
Right. To put that scale into perspective, that is a population roughly equivalent to the entire United States, completely exposed in a single centralized failure.
So how do you even steal 3.65 terabytes of data from a company whose entire business model relies on security? Was this some highly sophisticated Ocean's 11-style vault heist?
Not even close. It was actually a textbook exploitation of a peripheral system. They found a stored cross-site scripting vulnerability, an XSS vulnerability in Instructure's free for teacher support ticket system.
Wait, Instructure is the company that makes Canvas, right?
Yes.
And the hackers got in through a free sport tier.
Yes. And this happens all the time in supply chain security. Organizations will spend millions securing their core production environments, you know, the digital front door.
Right.
But they often neglect the side windows like third-party vendor portals or free support tiers. What the hackers did was inject malicious code into a support ticket. Yeah. So when an Instructure administrative staff member opened that ticket just to read it, the code silently executed in the background. It stole the staff member's session token, which is essentially their digital ID badge, and that granted the attackers full administrative access to the entire centralized database.
That is wild.
Yeah.
And the response from Instructure is almost infuriating. They actually paid the ransom to the hackers.
They did.
But they didn't pay to get encrypted data back. They paid in exchange for what Shiny Hunters called shred logs. They literally paid the hackers for a promise that they deleted the stolen data.
Yeah.
That is like paying a burglar to promise they threw away the copies they made of your house keys. It's absurd.
It is, and security professionals universally advise against this because there is zero technical mechanism to guarantee the hackers didn't keep a backup or, you know, sell it on the dark web before shredding the logs.
So what happens now? Because this feels like a scenario where millions of students get an apologetic email offering a year of free credit monitoring, and then everyone just moves on.
Well, the regulatory fallout could be much more severe this time. In the U.S., you have FERPA, which legally protects student education records. And in Europe, obviously, you have the GDPR.
Right.
Historically, enforcement in edtech has been somewhat lax because schools tend to prioritize feature sets and low costs over robust security architecture.
That makes sense.
But exposing 275 million records, that crosses a threshold. We are likely going to see regulators step in and establish strict, enforceable minimum security standards. But more importantly, we are seeing institutions actively researching distributed systems.
Like breaking things up.
Exactly. Breaking their data up across multiple vendors so that a single breached support ticket doesn't compromise global education data.
Yeah, because we just saw how a single centralized database can bring down 9,000 schools.
Mm-hmm.
That terrifying fragility is exactly why some industries are actively running in the opposite direction, favoring sprawling neighborhoods over massive skyscrapers. Which leads us perfectly into how the gaming industry is mitigating risk.
Yeah, the THQ Nordic Digital Showcase 2026 is a great example of this.
So what was their strategy there? Because it seemed really different.
Well, THQ Nordic is operating on a fundamentally different philosophy than the major AAA game publishers that normally dominate the headlines.
Right, because during this single showcase, they revealed an incredible 29 games in development, with 12 of them being brand new announcements.
Yeah.
They showed off everything from, like, the modernized combat of the Gothic 1 remake to the destruction physics of Wreckfest 2 and even Way of the Hunter 2. But it wasn't the specific titles that caught my eye. It was the sheer volume of it all.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, THQ Nordic is functioning much more like a diversified financial portfolio than a traditional game studio. You have survival simulators, action RPGs, racing games, even pinball.
Right.
By spreading their bets across so many different genres and audience demographics, they are deeply mitigating their risk profile.
Because the traditional AAA model right now is honestly terrifying. A major studio will spend, what, $300 million in 5 years developing one massive game.
Either.
And if that single centralized bet flops at launch, the studio might literally shut down and lay off hundreds of people.
We've seen it happen.
Exactly. But THQ Nordic seems to be saying, hey, let's release 29 mid-budget games. If four of them bomb completely, the company doesn't even flinch.
And they pair that volume strategy with brilliant lifecycle management. During the showcase, they ran deep discount sales across platforms like Steam and Xbox. They offered 25% off newly announced franchise entries like Reanimal, 50% off mid-tier games like SpongeBob, and up to 85% off legacy franchises like Darksiders.
It's the perfect funnel. You are watching the stream, you get excited about a new trailer, and immediately realize you can buy the older games in the series for the price of a cup of coffee. It keeps their entire back catalog generating revenue.
Exactly.
But, what does this all mean for the medium of gaming itself? Like, I get the business logic of playing it safe, but if your entire strategy is mitigating risk through sheer variety, does that ultimately cap your ceiling?
How do you mean?
Like, if you never push the boundaries, if you never risk the entire company on a massive visionary project, do you ever create a culture-shifting masterpiece?
That is the ultimate trade-off of a diversified portfolio. You rarely produce a cultural phenomenon that defines a generation when you play it completely safe. However, there is a massive exception to this rule.
Okay, what's that?
You don't necessarily need to risk the entire company on a single piece of software if you control the centralized platform that everyone else's software has to run on.
Ah, right. If you own the casino, you don't need to bet your life savings on the roulette wheel. You just take a cut of everyone else's bets.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the ultimate platform owner, Nintendo.
Yes. Nintendo just released their Q1 financial results for the fiscal year ending March 2027, and the numbers for the Switch 2 are staggering.
Really staggering. As of June 30, 2026, they have sold 23.68 million units worldwide. Yeah. In less than 18 months, the Switch 2 has already surpassed the total lifetime sales of the GameCube, which was around 21.7 million. And the geography breakdown is interesting, too. America's leading at 33.5%, Japan at 28.3%, and Europe trailing at 22.7%.
Right.
And the attach rate, meaning the number of games the average person buys for the console, is a really healthy 2.46. People are highly invested in the ecosystem.
They are. But the metric that truly defines the future of the industry is their digital sales. Nintendo reported a 90% increase in digital sales year over year.
That never just blew my mind. Like, I want you to think about your own shelf at home right now. Are you still buying physical boxes with cartridges in them? Or is clicking download on the digital storefront just too frictionless to resist? A 90% jump implies the physical game collector is rapidly becoming a niche minority.
Oh, absolutely. And from a purely financial perspective, Nintendo loves this transition. Digital sales completely eliminate the manufacturing costs for physical cartridges, there are no global shipping logistics, and they don't have to split the revenue with physical retailers. It is pure centralized profit margin. But it ties directly back into our theme of the risks of centralization.
Because you don't actually own a digital game.
Precisely. You own a digital license to access that game on a centralized server. If Nintendo eventually shuts down that server 10 years from now, or if a user gets locked out of their account, that purchase simply vanishes.
Wow.
We are trading long-term ownership and preservation for immediate convenience. And despite this massive success, Nintendo's reliance on centralized manufacturing is currently bottlenecking them.
Right, because they are facing severe supply chain issues with custom OLED panels and specific chip components, meaning they can't actually manufacture consoles fast enough to meet demand. Plus, they have the PlayStation 5 Pro launching at a similar price point with vastly superior graphical power. Nintendo is entirely reliant on the strength of its exclusive, walled garden ecosystem to compete.
And this brings our entire journey today full circle.
It really does. I mean, we started with the visionary leaders at Google stepping away from corporate bureaucracy, pushing back against a centralized structure to chase AGI on their own terms.
Right.
We look at how that thirst for computing power is leading AMD and Talos to physically carve AI models into stone, sacrificing all flexibility for the sake of hyper-specialized efficiency.
Yeah, and then we examine the catastrophic dark side of that centralized efficiency with the Canvas breach, where a single exploited support ticket exposed the data of 275 million students.
And finally, we saw how the gaming industry is reacting, with THQ Nordic surviving through rapid decentralized diversification, while Nintendo rides a massive surge in digital sales, fully embracing a centralized platform-controlled future.
Which leaves us with a final thought to really mull over. As we look at those hardwired Talalus chips and that fragile Canvas database side by side, a clear pattern emerges. As our technology becomes increasingly hardwired and hyper-specialized for efficiency, both physically in our silicon and structurally in our centralized cloud platforms, are we willingly trading away the very flexibility, ownership, and resilience that allowed this incredible era of rapid innovation to happen in the first place?
Are we building towering, fragile skyscrapers when what we really need to survive the future is a resilient neighborhood? It is a huge question to consider. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Remember, the tech and gaming landscapes never sleep, and the underlying systems shaping our world are changing by the minute. Stay insanely curious, and we will catch you on the next one.